Welcome, everyone, to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all characters and styles and their enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration. Please enjoy. And to find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the next hour for this very special author-to-author Goldster conversation, where my guest's pen is behind three great works, the autobiographical Leading from the Front, a second book, Boots on the Ground, and out in September this year, the co-authored From Victory to Defeat, the British Army from 1918 to 1940. That is the period between two world wars, which ended with the stark and horrendous, that was the right words, wake-up call of the flight from Dunkirk. Why did it happen? What parallels, if any, are afoot at the moment? We will find out from a guest whose career began as a young soldier fighting on the streets of Northern Ireland, who was struck down by a stroke in his mid-20s, but he gathered the grit and resolve to pick himself up, brush himself down, and pursue a military career to take the top job in the army. We're going to talk about Britain's security. We're going to ask how devout Christianity sits alongside the craft of modern and often brutal warfare, as we're currently seeing in the Middle East. Oh, and he was also Constable of the Tower of London. What does that evolve? So with that, welcome, General the Lord Dannett to Goldster, author to author.
Humphrey, good evening. It's great privilege to join you. And I'm looking forward to our conversation over the next hour or so.
So am I, very much so. But before we start, you have a lot of titles. You're general, you're a knight of the realm, you're a baron and a lord. What should I call you?
To be honest, probably better if you call me Richard.
You're Richard.
Actually, my first name is Francis, but after I had 16 years of being confused with a girl's name, I said, I'm going to be called by my second name now. So I ditched Francis and I'm called Richard. The BBC actually still calls me General Sir Richard Dannett, but they'll eventually get to change after about 12, 13 years. Never mind.
So which one supersedes the other? When you become a general, the knighthood goes, or when you become a baron, the lord goes? I mean, how does it work?
General is just a military rank. During the course of the time that I was a general, I was knighted. So I became General Sir Richard Dannett. And then having left the army in 2009, in 2011, I went into the House of Lords. So we dropped the Sir Richard bit and General the Lord Dannett, which is my correct title now. But it's all far too complicated. People get themselves a terrible muddle. Far better to call me Richard. But don't, Francis. Okay.
For all our audience, you can ask Richard anything you want. You can comment on anything he says. Put it in the chat and I will pass it on in the course of our conversation, anything that arises. I Wikipedia'd you before we went on, Richard. And as a boy, you wanted to be a cricketer and then a barrister. So what made you become a soldier?
Well, cricket is a game I've always loved. In fact, I still play cricket, which given that I'm 73 this month, I'm actually quite proud about. And because I could never develop a really good cricket career, my daughter, my youngest child of four, she married a professional cricketer. And Greg, her husband, played 12 years first-class cricket for Leicestershire and Nottinghamshire. So I've actually done that ambition through my son-in-law. That's wonderful. When I was at school, I rather hankered after joining the army, which my mother was absolutely appalled by. Her generation, her father, my grandfather had fought in the First World War. My father fought in the Second World War. He was abroad for 4.5 years in India. Otherwise, I might have been 4.5 years older, I suppose. So when I said that actually I wanted to join the army, my mother, my parents were surprised. My mother was appalled. But when I was at school, those older and wiser than me said, well, yes, okay, but actually we think probably you ought to apply to Oxbridge. Think about reading law and what about becoming a barrister? Well, I was quite dutiful as a boy. I did the Oxford exams and was quite pleased, I think, to be called to Cambridge for an interview to read law. And a friend said, one question you're bound to be asked is, do you do any law reading? And a really good answer to give is, yes, sir, I read the law reports in the Times. Well, I remembered this and the interview was going quite well. And then the question came, Do you do any law reading? Yes, sir, I heard myself say. I read the law reports of the Times. I thought, good answer. What cases recently have interested you? Well, you only had to be vaguely news aware in the late 60s of the Bodies on the Moor trial. And I said, the Bodies on the Moor trial, Hendley and Brady and whatever. I thought, good, you mentioned the name of the trial. And what about that case did you find so interesting? And I thought we were getting really quite below the belt here. As quickly as I could, I said, well, the fact that criminals got away with it for so long. And he looked over his half glasses at me and said, I think, Mr. Dunlap, you might be better suited to joining the police force than reading law in this college. So I did what I wanted to do, which was go to Sandhurst, join the army, which I duly did in September 1969 and commissioned into the Green Howards in July 1971.
And I'd like to just go back, as you're mentioning the wiser people than you at school. I should declare an interest here in that we happened to go to the same school, didn't we?
And it did.
It was what they call a public school or a private school or whatever, but it wasn't Eton, Harrow, Winchester, these ones that we hear about all the time. Explain what exactly was or is the school now, and where does it stand in your life?
Well, St. Lawrence College, I think, would probably classify as a minor public school. I think probably when you were there and I were there, the nature of the school, its charitable foundation, actually was an evangelical Christian school, Church of England school, which was why we had a lot of missionaries' children, children who were, whose parents were stationed overseas. Being in Kent, we had a lot of Kent farmers as well. I've been back a number of times over the years. I've done speech day and I've handed out the prizes. I've inspected the combined cadet force. And I've noticed, and of course, in our day, it was almost entirely a boarding school. Schools evolve over time. It's now sort of fairly large proportion of day children, boys and girls. In our day, it was only boys, boys and girls now. And a lot of them are day pupils, and a number are still boarding. And interestingly, there's a debate going on within the school about whether it should still keep evangelical in its charitable objectives. People will have a view on that. I think my parents, who were very Christian-minded, picked St. Lawrence for me because of the evangelical charitable status. And that's probably why I went there. But there we go. Schools evolve over time. And yes. I hope St. Lawrence College continues to flourish.
Yes, it is very interesting because it was the sons of diplomats, missionaries, as you say, soldiers who were posted abroad. And therefore, those children didn't have a place to go to in because they didn't have state boarding schools, did they? So they had to go to places like St. Lawrence College.
And indeed, and of course, that still happens with a lot of children from military families even today, because families move around. But to give children stability of education, boarding school is often the only option, or it's the best option to give a child a stable education, even if their parents are on the move. So like a lot of boarding schools, St. Lawrence had quite a lot of military families or children from military families for exactly that reason. And that continues with public schools today.
Is there any one thing that you take away from your school days, Richard, that gave you a backbone for life or gave you some wisdom?
Well, I think role models. My housemaster, Martin Harvey, he was a clergyman. He had been a chaplain on destroyers during the Second World War. He had a Distinguished Service Cross. As young boys, we totally admired him. So I think role models are important as a takeaway from school. I was part, as we all had to be, of the combined cadet force at school. And most people didn't like it and tried to leave at the earliest opportunity, probably because I had this hankering after the military and joining the army. I did quite enjoy it. So perhaps unsurprisingly, I became the senior under officer, the senior boy, if you like, in the cadet force, and thoroughly enjoyed that. And perhaps that was part of my thinking why I left school in July 1969 and following September, 2 months later, having gone around this business of not going to Cambridge to read law to be a barrister, went to Sandhurst as an officer cadet and started that two-year course.
Yes. So you went to Sandhurst and you came out and fairly quickly after you graduated from Sandhurst, you found yourself in Northern Ireland, you talked about your housemaster's medal. There was a day there, wasn't there, where you earned a military cross. Could you tell us what happened, how young you were, how that unfolded?
In general terms, I think it's fair to reflect, and it is worth reflecting. And the younger generation now just don't seem to realise that in the early 1970s, the degree of violence in Northern Ireland was very intense. In 1972, for example, 102 British soldiers lost their lives in Northern Ireland. Now, that's a large figure, and actually was larger than the worst years of Iraq and Afghanistan put together. So put that in the context of 102 British soldiers losing their lives within the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland. That's gives an idea. So, I commissioned on the 30th of July, 1971. Now, before we send people on operational postings, we give them 3 to 6 month pre-deployment training. Well, 30th of July, I commissioned. On the 14th of August, just over 3 weeks later, I was commanding 7 Platoon B Company, 1st Battalion of the Green Hearts, on the streets of Belfast. I took over a platoon of 27 soldiers, and 3 weeks later, I was down to 19. As another indication of the degree of violence.
And you mean getting killed and shot and injured?
Most of those were blown up, and two of them were shot. Mercifully, on that occasion, they all recovered. During my second tour in Northern Ireland, which wasn't very long after that, it was over the winter 1972-73, a variety of things happened, as always do on operational deployments. On one occasion, my platoon was part of a composite company in a reserve role. We were stationed in Andersonstown in southwest Belfast when we knew there was going to be trouble in East Belfast. So my company of soldiers was moved during the course of the day at no minute's notice from one side of the city to the other. It was a part of the city we didn't know at all. And quite shortly, having got there, serious rioting broke out. I was ordered to take my platoon to dominate a particular road junction in East Belfast. On the way to that, through the crowds, we came under fire. Having got to that road junction, which had three roads going each way, I deployed one of my sections of soldiers, a group of 10 soldiers each, dominating each of the three routes. But the route we'd just come up, we continued to be under fire from. And frankly, not knowing the area very well, I came to the conclusion that the only way we could solve this problem was to attack.
Who was firing on you?
Well, we were in East Belfast, and this was a loyalist Protestant area. And it so happened that the way Northern Ireland politics were at that time, this was a Protestant rebellion, if you like, or serious points being made against the government. So for most of my time in Northern Ireland, we were fighting with and against the IRA. But on this occasion, actually, it was Protestant extremists, which was pretty depressing, to be absolutely honest. Anyway, cut a long story short, we couldn't just stay where we were being fired at. So I took one of my sections and we counterattacked down the street. We did kill two terrorists. The others gave up. I reckoned we'd probably stabilized the situation at that stage. I withdrew back down to the street where the rest of my platoon was. I was just in the process of giving orders to one of my corporals when two other terrorists had outflanked us down a side street. They opened up. My corporal I was talking to fell with a bullet in the chest, and my driver, who was down beside me acting as a sentry, fell with a bullet in the back. It's quite unnerving, I can tell you, when the two guys either side of you drop with gunshot wounds. That just gives you a flavour of the intensity of that day. My driver sadly subsequently died. The corporal recovered. But again, it gives a sense of the intensity of the difficulties we were having trying to combat the IRA, the nationalist element, but also dealing with the volatile politics of the unionist element who felt they couldn't always get their message through to the government in Westminster.
And then you say it's some stage. Just how did you get out of that situation? I have you there with your two sort of men, more experienced than you, I presume, are both shot. How did you get out?
I think everybody realised, and the terrorists, for want of a better word, realised that they'd taken quite a bloody nose that day. And sometimes when there's been a sharp reaction, things just quietly simmer down. And things did simmer down that evening, and such we were able to withdraw later on and ultimately go back from East Belfast to Southwest Belfast, where we were living. And that was actually interesting because I was living in two council houses with my platoon of soldiers in the middle of 50 empty houses. And we had nationalist families up the hill who wanted to come and occupy these houses. And we had Protestant families who had previously occupied them but didn't want to live there anymore. But the policy was that these houses could only be lived in by Protestants. They couldn't be lived in by Catholics. So you can imagine the tension that was going on within that part of Belfast. And that's symptomatic of how population shifted within Belfast, an area that had always been traditionally Catholic, an area that had been traditionally Protestant. Pressure came and populations changed.
Yes.
I must just tell you this.
Yeah.
One day, in this very complex situation, I was very encouraged to hear that the general officer commanding, a three-star general, was coming to visit. So he duly arrived, and I was only a second lieutenant, sort of one star on my shoulder. He duly arrived, and I gave him a briefing on the problem that we had. I took him on a patrol around the area. And then I said, "Sir General, that's the problem. What do you suggest I do?" And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Richard, we've got very broad shoulders in the British Army. I suggest you just muddle through." And, you know, to this day, I always rather felt we absolutely have to do better than muddling through. And that's something throughout my career I've been absolutely increasingly obsessed with. That whatever situation you're in, you've got to decide what the objective is, what the strategic objective is. You know where you are, you know where the problem on the ground is, and you've got to map out a route that takes you from where you are to where you want to get to be. And we would call that in the military a campaign plan.
Right.
If I was working in industry, I'd probably call it a business plan.
Yeah.
You know, I know what I want to do in terms of profit. I know where I am now. This will be my business plan. But in military terms, we need a campaign plan to take us in a series of steps, battles and engagements to the strategic objective, which ultimately is success or the end of the conflict or a resolution of the problem.
I mean, isn't there something in the British psyche that we're rather proud of our muddle through track record?
But it's not good enough. It's not good enough. The day of the gifted amateur has gone. We need to be professional about what we do.
Yeah.
You know, today we've been listening to extracts from the COVID inquiry, and you know, Boris Johnson had a Dickens of a problem, but you can just tell how they struggled to work out what the strategic objective was. Yes, of course, it's the health of the nation, but how are you going to get there? What were the strategies? What were the tactics that needed to be employed? What was the plan? So, you know, the flip side of the coin to muddling through is proper planning and knowing how you're going to get from where you are to where you want to get to.
And the COVID inquiry is underpinned by muddling through, is it?
I wouldn't say it's underpinned by muddling through. I think it's characterized by muddling.
Can I just go back before we move on? Is you said there were these two communities and the empty houses and the policies that one community could not live in the other's houses. Was this a government policy that Catholics couldn't live in Protestant houses and vice versa?
It was the Northern Ireland government's current policy that houses that had been traditionally occupied by one sector of the community or the other could only be lived in by that section of the community. Because what they wanted to do was to get people to move back into their own areas and not be forced out by the other community. And if you looked at the time at the map of Belfast, you could actually see how the green colour, which was the nationalist colour, was pressing the orange colour out of parts of the city. And so the policy was to make sure that there was no more movement of populations, which is why 50 houses had been occupied by Protestants. They had fled. A number of their houses had been burnt and torched, and this happened fairly frequently in Northern Ireland. But we were not allowed to allow Catholic families who were backed up two or three families to a house up the hill. We were not allowed to let them come into living in these empty houses. And you can just imagine, as a young second lieutenant, you've got a real problem. You know, you are a small town mayor. And both communities were frightened of each other. Both set up vigilante groups to patrol. Well, on the one hand, we couldn't really allow that. But on the other hand, practically, I knew it was a sensible thing to do. So I let them patrol around their own areas, but said to them, if you see anything wrong, come and tell us and we'll deal with it. And I will just, we're at risk of being too lengthy. The Catholic vigilantes were all forming up one evening before they started their patrol. But to show that we were in charge, I stepped out from the shadows and started to inspect them, just to sort of make the point that we were in charge. Now, the place was called Lenadoon, which had a bit of a Western feel to it. And I used to carry, terrible to say this, a Smith & Wesson .38 revolver on a low-slung holster. And my soldiers gave me a star and called me the Sheriff of Lenadoon. Well, this was fine. The sheriff was inspecting the Catholic vigilantes with a stick under my arm as well and my six gun on my hip. When down the hill, I saw two Land Rovers coming, and it was the commanding officer and his patrol, and I'd been caught red-handed. I marched across, saluted very smartly, and said, "Evening, Colonel, Catholic vigilantes are on parade and ready for your inspection." The regimental sergeant major went absolutely ballistic. Well, I got a terrible telling off the next morning. I probably quite rightly deserved it.
Just for very briefly, the characteristic of the British Army, which you headed, and we'll get to that in a minute, encourages this on the ground, out of the box thinking that's breaking rules.
Yes, I mean you've got to be flexible. I mean, nobody at Sandhurst had taught me how you administer a housing estate in which you have two conflicting sectarian groupings squabbling over 50 empty houses in the middle. You've got to use your imagination and use your discretion. I mean, yes, as a platoon commander, I had a company commander and he had a battalion commander. But I mean, it was very hard for anyone to give us direction. We had to use our wit and make it up as we went along.
And then you came out of these tours and at the very young age of 26, I think I'm right there, you had a stroke.
Well, I did, sort of. But along the way, I thought to myself after a couple of tours in Northern Ireland, perhaps I should have gone to university. And there was a scheme by which the army would allow a small number of officers to go to civilian universities to read for an arts degree. So in 1973 to 1976, I went to Durham University and I read economic history. And the byproduct of that was that I met Philippa, my wife, because we overlapped while we were there.
Brilliant.
We both graduated in summer 1976 and I rejoined my regiment, which by that stage was in Berlin. So we started our married life in Berlin. Again, it's something that the younger generations don't really clock, that Berlin in those days was a divided city administered by the British, the French, the Russians, and the Americans, the victors of the Second World War. But Berlin was 100 kilometers behind the Iron Curtain. So you had this little enclave of West, 100 kilometers behind the Iron Curtain. So it was a fascinating place to start our married life. We got married on the 19th of March, 1977. And then on the 11th of November, 1977, Armistice Day, the day we remember, I was the adjutant of the battalion by the time. We were due to have our Armistice Day service. It was a Friday afternoon, which as adjutant I was responsible for. They had the service, but then they realized I wasn't there. And I had collapsed on the floor of battalion headquarters with a major stroke. Was carted off to the main teaching hospital in Berlin. I was paralyzed completely down one side, gobbledygook coming out of my mouth. And I was in that hospital for a month, unable to do very much for 3 months. And it took me a full 2 years before I was completely fit again. But fortunately, I was able to recover sufficiently to continue my military career and ultimately became head of the army. But when you've had incidents like the soldiers on either side of you being shot, on another occasion in Northern Ireland, I'd been with three other soldiers who had gone 30 yards ahead of me, and they were standing on 70 pounds of commercial explosive, and they were all killed. right under my nose. I had been just behind them up to that moment. So there was several occasions there when I could have been killed. But when you've had a stroke, and interestingly, the German consultant who saw my wife that night when she was brought to see how I was, she said to me, "Tell me, how's it going? What will happen?" And he said, "Well, 'tis how you say in England, 50-50, we win some, we lose some." So I then found, having been rushing around Belfast and places like that, and Durham University and getting married and in Berlin, you know, too busy getting on with life, paralyzed and in bed for a month was a wonderful opportunity to reflect on life. And I found that really quite salutary, that I just had to stop and think about what was really important in life. And I reflected on those occasions when I could have been killed and I wasn't. And I reflected on the Christian faith that I'd been brought up in and began to think to myself, well, if this is life for real, this isn't the dress rehearsal, this is our one performance, this is our one chance to get it right, then actually the Christian faith that I believe is right is something that I want to follow wholeheartedly. So, you know, without sounding too saintly about it, I then decided that Christian faith was the one that I wanted to follow, and follow it properly and thoroughly. I committed myself to do that. Now, I'm not perfect. I still get things wrong. I'll ask my wife, she'll tell you the whole time, and all the rest of it. But that was, there's influences of not being killed in Northern Ireland, of surviving a stroke, really made me reflect on what was really important in life. And I came to the conclusion, it was the claims of Jesus Christ.
You write in the book there that you reflected that you'd been living a pretty selfish and self-serving existence.
Well, I think that's right. I think we, as young officers, just the example I gave of being the sheriff of Lenadoon. I mean, exactly. we were living life on the edge, frankly. And we soldiered hard. We enjoyed our sport. We partied hard. I'd fallen in love. I'd got married. I'd been to university, wrapped up in all that. So one was just getting on with living life in the moment.
And did you think,
realizing that actually there was more to it than that?
Did you think about leaving the army, of not going back?
Yes. This is an interesting question. Well, when I'd met Pippa, who I subsequently married, when we were both at Durham University, I did say to her that, yes, I am in the army and I've been in the army for a while, but I'm not intending to stay in the army that long. And she always claims she could take me to court under the Trade Descriptions Act for mislabeled goods because I did stay in the army. Although, going forward, there were two occasions when I thought I probably would leave. I felt, as a young captain a couple of years after that stroke, I owed it to Pippa to consider other career options. But cut a long story short, I went for a number of interviews, a number of jobs, so a couple of things I could have gone to. I also at the same time sat the Staff College entrance exams. And although I sat them on a day when I had a raging temperature and flu, was quite surprised to find that I'd passed. And I kind of took that as an indication that perhaps I should stay in the army.
The Staff College means that's when you go up into the managerial ranks, is it?
Yes, it's a year's intensive training for senior appointments. So I did that, and I said to myself and to my wife, well, I'm going to stay for the foreseeable future. I put sort of 10 to 15 years on the foreseeable future, and come 10 to 15 years later, I was just finishing commanding my regiment. Well, I thought I ought to consider leaving again, and I went to see a friend who was a headhunter in London. We had a reasonable conversation. I walked down Birdcage Walk and turned across Regent's Park. And on that bridge across the lake at Regent's and St. James's Park, I bumped into a friend who said, well, what are you doing here? I thought you were commanding your regiment up in the north. I said, well, I am, but I'm thinking of leaving the army. And he said, well, this was 1990, this recession that's about to kick in is going to be so deep and so long that if you even half enjoy the job you're doing, my advice is stay in it. Well, frankly, I looked heavenwards and thought, well, if God wants me to stay in the army, that's where I'll stay. And I told my wife, I'm afraid I'm here for the duration now. And the duration was going all the way through to eventually be Chief of General Staff.
And so, and you after Northern Ireland, after the stroke, you emerged out and with this decision making. You were what I call the post-Cold War wars. You did the Bosnian War, the Kosovo War, and yes, the Balkans, then Iraq and Afghanistan, rising up all the time. How would you characterize those wars, particularly Iraq and Afghanistan, I think, against your Sandhurst training and the sort of history of fighting big armies together?
Well, the first 20-odd years I was in the army was really characterized in the main by two things. One was the continuing commitment to Northern Ireland. And Operation Banner, as we called it, ran for 38 years from 1969 right through to 2007. Remember, I said I joined the army in 1969, and by 2007, I was chief of the general staff. So that 38-year operation completely encompassed me from officer cadet to chief of the general staff. The other major influence was preparing to fight the Soviets and the Warsaw Pact in Central Europe. So the army I joined had 55,000 soldiers in four armored divisions based in Germany. So we spent a lot of time in Germany preparing for the Cold War becoming hot. Now, of course, we all know the Berlin Wall came down in 1989 and the Cold War ended. And of course, the irony is that 1989 was followed by 1990, which is when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So in a sense, the army morphed from the dust of the Berlin Wall falling into the dust of the desert in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Iraq. Now, many people actually thought the first Iraq war was something of an aberration. This was not the new normal. Francis Fukuyama talked about the end of history. And chancellors and finance ministers across Europe were determined to take a peace dividend, reduce their defense budgets. In this country, we reduced the size of the army by a third. We've come to the end of history. We closed the military hospitals. We were never going to get involved in this kind of thing again. But it was only the next year, 1992, that we found ourselves getting drawn into the Balkans conflicts, first Bosnia and then Kosovo. And over time, I was commander of British forces in Bosnia, and I was commander of British forces when we went into Kosovo in 1999.
But that was throughout the 90s, wasn't it? Because you did 1992, Kosovo was, what, 98, 99?
It was 99. I mean,
yes.
So, I mean, I was in and out of the Balkans throughout that 10-year period.
And you reminded me, we were talking about thinking out of the box, and you reminded me to ask you about your bank raid. Was the Balkans? You became a bank robber.
1995-1996, we brought the Bosnian War to an end, managed a ceasefire, and then the Dayton Peace Accords were signed, and our task then was to get the armies out of the field, to cool the situation down, and to encourage the people to take a hand in their own future, to vote in the elections. And I had a weekly radio program on Radio Big in Banja Luka, and between the awful Balkan music, I told the people to get stuck in, to vote, take a hand in their future. And they took my advice literally. The turnout was over 100%. They'd voted on the Belfast principle of vote early, vote often. But the sadness was that the hardliners still retained power at the ballot box. 4 years later, I was back in Bosnia, this time as the NATO deputy commander, when we had the next round of elections 4 years on. And this time, to our great pleasure, the more moderate parties won at the ballot box. But we noticed over the next few weeks that the hardliners still seemed to exercise power. And we analysed that, and we realised it was because they still controlled the money. So we traced the money to the head office of the Herzegovaca banker in the southern city of Mostar. And thinking about it logically, I said, well, look, the answer is, if that's where their money is controlled from, we've got to go and do the bank. Well, we hit the bank at 2 o'clock in the morning with a battalion of British soldiers. And over the next 4 hours, we removed everything from all five floors of the bank, every file, every disk, every computer. I'd got a team that came over. They looked more as if they'd come from the East End of London, as opposed to Herefordshire, to deal with the safes. My curiosity got the better of me, and after a number of explosions in the cellars, I went down to see how we were getting on. And there was a long-haired soldier pulling money out of a hole in the safe. And he looked up at me and said, a bit singed, these ones, Gov. Anyway, come 6 o'clock in the morning, we locked the front door of the bank and I gave the key back to the night watchman. And to be fair, he hadn't had a very good shift. But before we left, I took him to the top floor of the bank where the vending machine was, with the Coke, the crisps and the chocolate. And although we'd taken everything but everything out of the bank, we'd blown the safes, we'd taken the money, we were not thieves and vandals. The Coke, the crisps and the chocolate were all still in place. I also didn't think it was helpful to tell him that we'd removed a large section of the back wall of the bank through which the engineers had dragged out the mainframe computers. But back in Sarajevo that night, I saw a couple of young soldiers. And I said to them, had a good day today, chaps. Oh, sir, it was great. We went down to Mostar this morning. We hit this bank. We took everything. We took the computers, the files. We blew the safes. We took the money. And it was legit.
Sounds like something out of a Clint Eastwood
movie. The moral
of
the story is that it broke the power of the hardliners and the peace agreement that was in danger of breaking up was preserved. So although we were not taught how to rob banks when I was at Sandhurst or at the Staff College, it was the right thing to do.
Yes, and that was your decision?
It was my decision. I had to get the Ministry of Defence to agree. We also had to get the French, who was in their area, to agree as well. But we did manage to get Paris and London to agree. And we care about the operation that I've just described. So I've robbed a bank.
It reminds me a bit of Michael Caine's The Italian Job or something like that, which would make a movie out of it. And I want to move on to the book you co-wrote with Robert Lyman, Victory to Defeat, which has a lot of themes that we're talking about now. But it's really the thinking, political thinking, military thinking, and the actual boots on the ground type of thinking on the security of Britain. One of the things that struck me is that you took a Today program team to one of the hairiest parts of Afghanistan there and had to be or were flown around in an American helicopter, and that became a bit of a sort of issue over here, that Britain didn't have enough helicopters or the right sorts of armoured vehicles and flak jackets and that sort of thing. Tell us your thoughts on all that.
Well, between 2005 and 2009, in the height of the Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns, I was Commander-in-Chief Land Command, that's the number two job in the Army, and then Chief of the General Staff, the number one job in the Army. The Army had been organized coming out of the defense review that Tony Blair's government had carried out in 1997-1998, just a few years before, to effectively carry out one of these extended operations, and we find ourselves doing two. Now, that's not a problem. As military people, we will do whatever the elected government of the day wants us to do, enabled by the government of the day giving us the resources that we need, the equipment that we need, make sure we got the manpower that we need, make sure we had the welfare support, the medical support. And frankly, in the 2 years that I was Commander-in-Chief, whose main task was preparing units to deploy, frankly, we could tell the pressure we were under and that we were lacking many of the things that we needed. So when I became Chief of the General Staff, I made not a nuisance of myself, but I made it pretty clear that, of course, we would do what needed to be done, but we needed the resources, we needed the money, we needed the welfare support, the weapons, decent equipment, decent vehicles to carry out the two missions when we were actually only organized to do one. Now, this had been going on between me and Tony Blair, me and Gordon Brown, 2006 till 2009. And yes, mid-2009, I took Sarah Montague of the Today program out to Afghanistan with me, and we visited various units. And we were standing on the dispersal flight line in Camp Bastion to fly up to Sangin, one of the more difficult areas. And I was expecting for us to fly in a RAF Chinook escorted by an Army Air Corps Apache, when two United States Army Black Hawks arrived. Now, what they said to me immediately, oh my goodness, we're so short of helicopters, they had to send two American ones. And I looked at Sarah and Sarah looked at me and I thought, I know what she's thinking because I'm thinking exactly the same. So of course, we carried on the visit up to Sangin, really difficult area, where the soldiers were literally fighting for their lives, and she reported fantastically from there. But then, of course, couldn't resist. The head of the British Army had to be flown around by an American pair of helicopters because we haven't got enough. And by the way, he's coming back to England with quite a shopping list. Well, General Dyer's shopping list became a bit of a cause célèbre. Actually, on the back of that, I managed to have a really sensible conversation with Gordon Brown and make the point, look, we'll do whatever you want us to do. You know, you are the elected government. We're just servants of the people. But we do need the resources. We do need the stuff to carry out these operations. So please, can you, you know, really bite the bullet? I know when you were Chancellor, you thought all of us in defence were real spendthrifts and wastrels, but actually we need this stuff to do the business. And in any fairness, he eventually saw the argument, and my successors were able to enjoy an uplift in spending. But frankly, I'd cooked my goose by that stage. And 28th of August 2009 was my last day as Chief of the General Staff. And there was only one place for me to go. That was the Tower of London. So
that's where, and we're going to talk about
it. No question of doubt, I've been Chief of Defence Staff. I thoroughly hacked off Blair and Brown. So, well, send him to the Tower.
I think Simon Jenkins of the Times called your comments on one of these issues either daringly brave or totally naive. Where would you put them?
Very brave.
Very brave. Yeah, and you got the results. Can I talk? You said that you will do anything the elected government of the day wants you to do. Can I ask you, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you're dealing with non-state actors, villagers that might be insurgents or farmers or something like that, and going in, and as you said, your soldiers fighting for their lives, how that sits with your Christian beliefs? Because it's a different thing than fighting Russia or fighting Germany, isn't it?
It is. I think the really important thing is at the end of the day, you've got to believe whatever the mission that your government has given you to do is right. We're now getting into what we call the just war tradition. Without being over lengthy about it, there are two major elements about that. Yeah. One, firstly, is it right to fight? And secondly, are we fighting right? Now, interestingly, put this in the context of Gaza and Israel today. Are the Israelis right to fight? Well, given that Hamas is sworn to destroy Israel, Israel probably is right to fight. That's the first element. The second element is to ask the question, are they fighting right? Are they doing it in a proportionate or a disproportionate way? So coming back to the personal, in virtually all the occasions while I was in the military, I was quite comfortable that what we were being asked to do was right. And then it was up to us to conduct those operations in a right manner. The outstanding, the outlier here is going into the second Gulf War in 2003, when our Prime Minister took us to war on the premise of weapons of mass destruction, on intelligence that said the weapons of mass destruction were there. The intelligence was very thin. The intelligence was wrong. And there is quite a case to say that the British people, British Parliament, and then the subsequent British military went into Iraq in support of the Americans in 2003 on a false premise.
Did you think it was right at the time? Did you think it was right? And it didn't contravene your moral beliefs?
Well, it's very interesting. In 2002, on the back of robbing the bank, I came back to London as the assistant chief.
Your moral compass swayed a little bit with the robbing the bank.
It was right to fight, and we were fighting right, just doing it differently. I was assistant chief of the general staff, so I was seeing the intelligence coming across my desk, and I thought, this is pretty uncompelling. And then I thought to myself, well, the really big stuff is being kept for the big boys. Then I thought, hang on, I'm the assistant chief of the general staff.
You're the big boy.
My boss, weekly chief, I'm one of the big boys now. So where is this compelling evidence? And frankly, it was never there. And I think the Chilcot inquiry and the Chilcot report, which eventually came out effectively in their 2.5 million words of the report, effectively said that the intelligence was not there. The arguments that took us to war in support of the Americans were very thin. We didn't know that at the time, but we do know it now. In fact, I used to share an office in the House of Lords with Lord Boyce, Admiral of the Fleet, Mike Boyce, who was the Chief of the Defence Staff in 2003, and he was so uncomfortable that he took personal legal advice to know whether he was right to go along with what the government had wanted to do. I mean, he was that concerned about it.
Can you imagine in the scenarios that you've given us, including robbing the bank, of a situation where you would be at odds with your Christian beliefs?
I think this, fortunately, in my experience, it's never happened. And generally, in the context of the British Armed Forces carrying out operations that the British government of the day has required, it has not been an issue. I think if you put it in the context of German soldiers with a Christian belief between 1939 and 1945, I think there were many times that people would have been in a contradictory situation between what they personally believed and what they were being required to do. Now this is a real dilemma for people, and this is where it comes down to moral courage. It is undoubtedly extraordinarily morally courageous if you're given an order to do something that you think is morally wrong to say, "I will not do it." That's your decision, and that's what you think is right. Within the context of an organized, disciplined military, you're really standing yourself in danger. But if you think that's the right thing to do, then undoubtedly it is the right thing to do. At the end of the day, we follow orders. But at the very end of the day, we are our own decision makers and have to be guided by our own moral compass. Your moral compass is undoubtedly tuned by whatever you believe in. And if you believe in the Christian faith, then that will take you in a certain direction.
That's a very clear answer. In Victory to Defeat, you studied the period between the wars, making the argument and with your co-author Rob Lyman, that to the extent that if we had continued to build up and project our armed forces, the Holocaust could have been prevented, the Second World War could have been prevented, we could have stopped Hitler in the mid-30s. Give us that thought.
Yes, I'll try not to be too lengthy for your listeners.
We've got 12 minutes left.
Okay, the basic premise of Victory to Defeat, the British Army 1918 to 1940, is to examine the circumstances whereby in November 1918 we defeated the German army on the battlefield, yet less than 22 years later we were defeated by the same German army or the next German army in France in May and June 1940. What happened in the interwar years that the largest British army that we'd ever fielded, which was so successful in 1918 against the Germans, was so incompetent in 1940. And it's a very multifaceted answer. I'm just trying to keep it fairly brief. There was a feeling, quite rightly, that the First World War was so awful that it really must be the war to end wars. And that got translated into a government policy that there would be no major war in Europe for 10 years. And that was rolled on year by year by year. That gave the government the perfect opportunity to reduce the size of the army, significantly reduce our expenditure on defense in the round. And as far as the military was concerned, the security of the United Kingdom was the Navy's problem. We're an island nation. And the army's job was to police the empire. So the majority of the army was in India, was in the Middle East, was in Palestine, was in parts of Africa, policing the empire. The failure in the interwar years by the army was not to analyze sufficiently clearly why and how it had been so successful in 1918, to make sure that we developed equipment, tactics, thinking, doctrine, such that we had the capacity to do it again if we needed it. The organization of the army was such that most of the focus was abroad, and the bit of the army that was at home was there simply for recruiting and training. Now, our wider argument is that if we had had in this country a couple of divisions, a deployable force of, let's say, 10,000 troops, that when Hitler was becoming resurgent, when Hitler was reoccupying the Rhineland, when Hitler was threatening Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia, if we'd had a force that we could have deployed along with the French to say that far and no more, it might well have paused Hitler in his expansion plans. It may even have gone so far as prevented the Second World War happening. And if the Second World War had not happened, then actually we could argue that the Holocaust probably itself would not have happened. And the wider point, and then I'll pipe down, the wider point is to look at the parallels between what was happening in the 1930s and what is happening now. In the 1930s, there was a dictator rising in Europe who was a threat. We chose not to confront him. We chose to appease him. In international politics, it's often said, speak softly with a loud stick. Chamberlain spoke loudly just with an umbrella. It cut no mustard at all with Hitler. So we failed in our appeasement of him. Today, we have a dictator in Europe, Vladimir Putin, who's not just a threat, he's a proven aggressor. Did we rearm in time in the 1930s? No. We just got away with it. The army was defeated in France. The Royal Air Force just won the Battle of Britain. Are we rearming? Are we spending enough money on our defense for the collective security of Europe today? I would argue that we were not. And my last thought is this, on this one. In 1935, we spent 3% of GDP, 3% of national income on defense. When the balloon went up in 1939, it suddenly shot up to 18%. And in 1940, we were fighting for our lives. It was 1946, it was 46%. Today, we're spending less than 2.4%. We're not even spending as much proportionally as we were in the dark days of the mid-1930s. Is that enough? Big question for our politicians these days.
And as we're drawing parallels, I'm thinking of the collapse in 2021 of Afghanistan, a totally different war, but we were very much involved and soldiers' lives were lost there. And part of your argument is thinking out of the box, new strategies, know your enemy, and that sort of thing. When that happened, Were you thinking, how could we have done this differently? Could it have ever worked? And what should we do now?
Two strands of thought there. The Afghanistan campaign was really difficult. We lost 455 of our own people in that campaign up to 2021. But from the period of the end of combat operations by the NATO forces and the British forces in 2014, the very small residual international force was there supporting the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police Force. And they were containing the Taliban pretty well, by and large, in the south of the country, which is their homeland. When it was decided by Trump and then agreed by Biden that we would all withdraw in August 2021, it was unnecessary. There are only 2,500 international troops there, and Afghanistan collapsed very quickly. Okay, that happened. Who was watching? Vladimir Putin was watching. He'd been watching in 2014 the reaction to the West when he annexed Crimea and went into eastern Ukraine. We huffed and puffed. We didn't do very much. In 2021, he watched us withdraw in an abject fashion from Afghanistan, and he came to the conclusion the West is weak and poorly led. It was only 6 months later that he decided to attack Ukraine in February 2022. So these issues are all overrelated. They lay on top of each other. And we are now where we are, dealing with a situation of Russia and Ukraine, us supporting Ukraine. And overlay on that, of course, the other complication now of Israel, Gaza, and Hamas.
Give us two things in a nutshell, if you could. What could we have done differently on the Afghanistan-Iraq thing? And what should we do right now?
Well, as far as Afghanistan is concerned, I first went there in 2004, and I came away with the conclusion that unless we really tackled the illegal drugs issue in Afghanistan, the growing of poppy to create opium, we will never get their economy on a sensible legal footing, which, if we don't do that, then corruption will remain absolutely rife. And we will not be able to get their civilization moving forward. We failed in that. And it was a real shame to do that. And in a sense, it was slightly downhill from there. But go back to my earlier comment. The small force that we still had there until middle 2021 was supporting the Afghan security forces sufficiently well who were containing the Taliban. Meanwhile, Afghan civil society was developing. Girls were being educated. There were over 300 female judges in Afghanistan. Their society was moving on. It was improving. It was getting better. So you must never feel that what we did in Afghanistan was a failure. The real sadness was the precipitate withdrawal, quite unnecessary, that I'm afraid has made it a failure.
So with 2,000 troops, we could have kept that going for 50, 100 years, whatever it takes to build a society up.
We were there in a mentoring and supporting role, and it would have been gradually allowed the Afghans to be able to control and contain and run their own country. And they were getting on with it well. Huge problems, of course, corruption still, all the rest of it. But it was getting better. Women were being educated. Girls were being educated. They were moving forward as a society.
And what should we as a nation do now for our security, given that canvas you just painted for us?
Well, I think what we have to remember is that we are a Northern European country. We are now a medium-sized country, but we still have historic responsibilities, both to parts of the Commonwealth. We also are one of the permanent five members of the UN Security Council, so we have international obligations. But I think what we've got to remember, when resources are finite, we've got to concentrate them on the highest priority. And the highest priority, remembering that we are a European country, is the security of Europe. Now, we've chosen to leave the European Union, but we definitely haven't left NATO. We definitely haven't abrogated our responsibilities towards the collective security of Europe. So that's where we ought to be putting our support. Yes, into Ukraine, but making sure that we, the British, can play a full part as European members of NATO. And I'm afraid that the Chancellor of the Exchequer won't like it, and I've talked to Grant Shapps about it. I gave him a copy of Victory to Defeat, that I'm afraid it means that we've got to spend more on defence. Not a vast amount more, but move it up to about 3% from less than 2.5%. That's between 10 and 15 billion pounds more. Bear in mind the defence budget is about 45 billion. The health budget is about 190 billion. The education budget isn't much less than that. What's the first duty of government? It's the preservation of the security and the sovereignty of our country and the safety of our citizens. So government's got to keep that priority in mind. We should be spending a bit more on defence, not a huge amount, a bit more to make sure that we can keep our country safe and our people safe and play our part within the collective security of Europe.
And one last thought, thank you very much for that. One last thought is that among your many titles that we discussed at the beginning, you mentioned you were also a constable of the Tower of London.
I was the constable.
The constable.
Constable. Now, the constable of the Tower of London. And William the Conqueror appointed the first, and I was the 159th, is the sovereign's representative in the Tower of London. Because we think of the Tower of London as a jail and a torture chambers and things, but actually it's an unoccupied royal palace. So the constable is the sovereign's representative in the Tower of London. So within the Tower of London, I was like Lord Lieutenant of a county, but in the environ of the Tower of London.
So there was a constable of the Tower of London when Anne Boleyn and Thomas More and others were being held there?
Absolutely. We lived in the Queen's house, which Henry VIII had built for Anne Boleyn, but after a while she kind of didn't need it.
And you look after the crown jewels, of course, don't you?
The crown jewels, very much responsibility of it. And the great joy is the Tower of London goes on making history. Just think to when the Olympic Games were held in London. The Olympic flame first came to the Tower of London. Dame Kelly Holmes ran around the tower and gave it to me. I made a speech, and Seb Coe made a speech, and Boris Johnson made a speech. Have we got 30 seconds?
Yes.
Boris Johnson said, "My, it's a wonderful thing to welcome a flame into the tower." Come to think of it, Henry VIII welcomed two old flames into the tower to be extinguished.
And then, of course, the poppies were laid out in front of it, weren't they, one year?
Well, that was during my time as well. We decided that as part of the commemoration of the First World War, 888,462 poppies, one for every British and Commonwealth soldier who lost their lives, would be planted in the moat of the Tower of London. And we estimate 5 million people came to see that. All the poppies were bought, and the profit we made, just under £10 million, we gave to service charities to help those who had been injured in recent campaigns. So there was nothing else to like about that.
Yeah. What a wonderful note to finish up with. But before I let you go, can you just give us one thought that we do on Goldster, on when times are really tough, like when you have your stroke or your that? Give us a line, a thought, a word that helps you get up and get through those sort of tough times.
I'm a great believer in hope. Hope isn't chance. Hope is the expectation of better things. And from a Christian point of view, we say that ensure and certain hope of your life in the future. And we have that sure and certain hope when we put our faith and trust in Jesus Christ, because he died for us and he died that we might live in sure and certain hope of the future life.
Thank you so much for that final thought and the uplifting story of the poppies. But Times Wing Chariot is Apollos. We have covered what a fascinating conversation from the future of the military to Christianity to the resolve and hope to get through things. I have learned a lot. Until tomorrow, when we are live from the Answer Live studio in Regent Street with Bonnie Greer and Lanre Oligarque, stay active, stay curious, keep questioning, stay involved, and of course, stay Goldster. And thank you, especially Richard, General, Constable, the Lord Dannett. Have I missed anything out there for giving us such a superb discussion? Thank you, Richard, very much.
Thank you. I much enjoyed it, Humphrey, and thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.goldster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us